Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, January 9th, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our discussion will focus on Common Core. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Our experts for today are both litigators in cases about Common Core. They are D. John Sauer, he's a partner at Clark & Sauer, LLC, and Jimmy R. Faircloth, Jr., he's a managing partner at Faircloth, Melton & Kaiser, LLC. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of them in the order I just introduced them, opening remarks of about 10 minutes each, and then, as always, we're going to turn to the audience for questions, so please do be ready with your questions. And with that, Mr. Sauer, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean, and I'd like to begin by thanking the Federal Society for hosting this teleforum and for generally hosting so many useful telefora that are keep us lawyers out in the field apprised of very interesting and important developments that relate to federalism, separation of powers, and related issues. I'd also like to thank my co-panelist, Mr. Faircloth, the former executive counsel to Governor Jindal of Louisiana, and is now counsel for Governor Jindal's lawsuit against the federal government challenging its implementation of the Common Core standards. It's a real honor to have you to be on the call and on the panel with you, Mr. Faircloth. I'd like to begin my discussion by having a brief review of the high-level history of the way that the federal government, the Federal Department of Education, has implemented the Common Core state standards, focusing not on the issues of educational policy raised by Common Core, in which I confess to not being an expert but only being a layperson, but focusing on the issues that relate to federalism, that relate to the separation of powers, the rule of law, and constitutional and limited government raised by the manner in which the federal government has herded, corralled, and coerced the states into adopting the Common Core standards. Some of these issues are the focus of a lawsuit that we are currently prosecuting in Missouri State Court that argues that the interstate consortia that are developing the assessments aligned with the Common Core state standards are unconstitutional interstate compacts to which Congress has never consented as required by the Compact Clause of Article 1, Section 10, Clause 3 of the United States Constitution. Another legal issue that I would just like to touch upon or focus the audience's attention on is the issue of whether the federal government had statutory or constitutional authority to impose the adoption of Common Core as a de facto condition of a state's receipt of a waiver of the requirements of the No Child Left Behind Act. These two issues, I think, raise very serious constitutional issues that are of grave concern, I think, to all citizens and especially lawyers. First, a brief history of the way the federal government has implemented Common Core. The Common Core state standards were developed by the National Governors Association and some other non-governmental entities in the last decade. They were finalized in 2010. But from the early days of the Obama administration, there appears to have been a systematic plan to induce the states to adopt Common Core and to replace that as a systematic federal educational policy to replace the pre-existing No Child Left Behind Act requirements. The stimulus bill that was passed in January of 2009 authorized Congress granted the federal department a broad authorization to give several billion dollars of additional education grants out to the states. This was the Race to the Top program in 2009, and then again in 2010, the federal department offered this grant money to the states, but made important conditions on the receipt of the grant to be essentially the adoption of Common Core. The states had to commit to compete for the first $5 billion or so dollars in phase one to adopting, quote, a common set of K through 12 standards. Over 40 states at that time made that commitment. This is a commitment which is in practice a commitment to adopt the Common Core standards. Not all the states received grant money, but several did. Most states made that commitment because this is before the time when there was a significant political controversy about or pushback about the Common Core standards. In 2010, there was the second phase of the Race to the Top grant funding, and in that phase, the federal department offered $370 million in grants to, quote, consortia or interstate groups of states who would apply and take the money for the express purpose of developing assessments that were aligned to the Common Core state standards. Again, over 40 states participated in this, I believe 44 states were initially members of one of the two interstate consortia that applied and received grants. Those two consortia are the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium, of which Missouri is a member, and PARCC, P-A-R-C-C, the Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers, which I believe Louisiana is a member, although Mr. Faircloth can correct me on that. These interstate consortia involved the states making some very interesting and questionable commitments to the consortia in order to apply for and be eligible for the grant money. They committed to the adoption of Common Core standards. They committed to use the assessments that would be developed using the federal grant money by the consortia of which they were members. In addition, these consortia had independent governance structures. Smarter Balance, in particular, had and has a governing board, an executive committee. It has its own independent staff. It has a fairly elaborate organizational chart. So these consortia are not merely bilateral agreements between states to enter into reciprocal legislative arrangements. They set up an independent governance structure. And the memorandum that the state signed to enter these consortia purported to involve a cession of state sovereignty over the key aspects of educational policy within the state's borders. So the states would commit to be bound by the judgment, the decisions of the governing board and the executive committee of Smarter Balance, for example, over very important issues of educational policy, including what assessments are being used in our public schools, what manner are these assessments being implemented, and so forth. The consortia also called for or provided for the substantial involvement of a federal program officer, an official within the Federal Department of Education, to be actively involved in the operation of the consortium as it develops assessments aligned to Common Core between 2010 and 2014. In addition, Smarter Balance includes restrictions on the state's ability to withdraw from the consortium. There are contractual commitments not to withdraw without submitting an application for withdrawal to the governing board of the committee, and this is very important as well. As of 2012, a very substantial practical obstacle to a state's withdrawal was imposed by the Federal Department of Education, and that obstacle came through the No Child Left Behind waiver program, the ESEA flexibility program, as it's called. The federal department said to the states, your deadline for compliance with No Child Left Behind is 2014. Virtually every state will be out of compliance at that time. We will categorically waive all the requirements that Congress has enacted through No Child Left Behind if the state will agree to adopt a carefully tailored, sort of preconceived set of conditions promulgated by the federal department to get out of that. And as important here, two key safe harbors. They're not necessarily necessary conditions, but they are critical safe harbors for being eligible for the No Child Left Behind waiver include commitment to the Common Core standards and membership in one of the two interstate consortia. all this is done by the federal government against the backdrop of 50 years of congressional policy, congressional statutes enacted going back to 1965, again in the 1970s in the Organic Statute of the Federal Department of Education, again in the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001. Congress has said again and again, the federal department shall not mandate, direct, or control programs of instruction or curricula in state and local educational agencies. So there is a substantial statutory obstacle to the federal department to directly mandate a uniform national curriculum, even though in the regulations of 2009 that were promulgated by the federal department, they stated that the purpose of the Race to the Top program and the encouraging states to go into the common set of K through 12 standards was to abolish the existing, quote, patchwork of state standards and to replace it with a uniform national standard. So the stated purpose and the clear, the indisputable purpose of this whole course of regulatory conduct was to herd and corral and, you know, induce the states to go into a system of a uniform national curriculum, uniform national set of assessments or tests and standards all aligned to the Common Core standards. This whole regulatory history raises very grave questions, constitutional questions, separation of powers questions, because the whole course of conduct appears to be carefully designed to end run around the pre-existing congressional policy enacted in multiple statutes over 50 years against the implementation of a national curriculum. In addition to that, it obviously raises major sort of federalism, 10th Amendment type problems, because educational policy is a core traditional area of state concern, and the Supreme Court has commented that the Elementary and Secondary Education Act reflects a pronounced aversion to the federalization of local education decisions. And what we have here is the Federal Department of Education engaging in aggressive federalization of local education decisions. There are two sort of focused constitutional issues that are, I think, ripe or overripe for litigation here, in addition to many others, some of which I'm sure Mr. Faircloth will address. One is the lead claim in our state case, which challenges the consortia, the interstate consortium, specifically Smarter Balance, but the same arguments would apply to PARC, as an unconstitutional interstate compact under the Compact Clause. We have arguments that it threatens the supremacy of the U.S. Congress by seeking to end run around 50 years of congressional policy. It threatens the sovereignty of the member states that formally commit to ceding their state sovereignty over education to the members of the to the sort of governance structure of the consortium, and it threatens the sovereignty of non-member states as a practical matter. The purpose of this whole course of conduct is to create a monopoly, so to speak, a near monopoly or educational cartel among a substantial majority of states. If 44 or 45 states are committed to the Common Core standards, it would place intense pressure on the other four or five, the opting out states, to remain opting out as college admissions and so forth become aligned to the Common Core. So once there's a critical mass, the federal department's evidence strategy was to have that critical mass essentially pressure the outlying states to come into the uniform national fold. So in addition to the Compact Clause problems generated by this, I think there is a grave question of the federal government's the legality, both constitutional and statutory, of the federal government's decision to offer a waiver of the provisions of the No Child Left Behind Act that is conditioned on a pre-existing set of conditions promulgated by the department itself, uniform across all of the states. There is statutory authority for waiving provisions of the No Child Left Behind Act, but that statutory authority does not include an authorization to impose pre-existing alternate conditions, especially not alternate conditions that the federal department has presented to Congress for passage and Congress has declined to pass. The big big picture is we have a course of conduct that amounts to what appears to be a very systematic federal overreach attempt to take over a core areas of state educational policy and an aggressive regulatory policy through the use of waivers of pre-existing statutory conditions that in many ways has been the hallmark of presidential administration in this administration. These are problematic issues. They are, I think, ripe to be challenged in court, and they raise grave questions concerning the separation of powers, federalism, and the rule of law. And with that, I would turn over the mic to Mr. Faircloth. Thank you.
Hi, thank you, John. This is Jimmy Faircloth. I am counsel to Governor Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. We are in Louisiana of litigation involving Common Core, some of which has been fairly well publicized. Dean, thank you very much for having me on this call. I'm not going to replow the background information that was covered very well by John. Instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about the case that we have here in Louisiana and some of the issues that are raised in that case and the arguments that we think support a conclusion that Common Core at base is just an intrusion of federalism that cannot be tolerated. There's a great line in the 1936 opinion in United States versus Butler that is usually cited in Tenth Amendment litigation, and almost every advocate of a Tenth Amendment position for the states would cite this language from Butler, and I submit there's never been a better example than what this means. There's a statement by the court in Butler which says that federal authority, spending authority in that case, cannot be wielded as a scheme for purchasing with federal funds submission to federal regulation of a subject reserved to the states. And that's very important because that's exactly what this is. This is not a situation where it's simply coercive spending, standing alone. Most Tenth Amendment cases, there's a search for what is the gray area in the Tenth Amendment, what's the extent to which the United States spending authority can be exercised up to that line. And there's been a fair number of cases that have discussed that. This case is different. Common Core is very, very different because what's happened is for 50 years, Congress itself has acknowledged and drawn the line. So in this instance, it's much easier than in other cases, for instance, the Dole case, which involved the conditions on spending federal funds on roadways that was tethered to the requirement that you have to raise drinking age to 21. There's no statement in the law as to what is the boundary in with regards to transportation spending. But in the realm of education, Congress has repeatedly stated that there are certain subjects that must be reserved for the states. And they've gone a little further in three or four different acts. They've not merely stated that nothing in this particular act shall be construed to authorize an intrusion into these areas. There actually is very affirmative language stating that this is we are here to acknowledge the rights of states. And the right of states in particular is the right under the Tenth Amendment to control its sovereign authority over a matter that is very, very local in nature. There's an article that an editorial that George Will wrote last year describing Common Core as the thin edge of a massive federal wedge. And that's exactly what it is. That is exactly what it is. I think that's very well stated. What happens here, and Will covers this in his op-ed, as he often does very well, stating that federalism, one of the real benefits of federalism is that we get the creativity of the laboratory of states and the laboratory of elected officials, be that governors or down to your local education leaders, and they test ideas, some of which some are good, some of which are bad, but at the end of the day, there is creativity and there is advancement and there is the evolution of policy in somewhat of a competitive, creative sense. What happens with Common Core is the elimination of that virtue. And that is admitted by the implementers of Common Core because what they want to do, and John cited the reference, there's a blueprint for Common Core piece that the department put out, where they stated that the principal justification for Common Core is to eliminate the patchwork of standards among the states. Well, it's that very patchwork of standards that Will's referring to. It's the creation of that patchwork, which is the virtue of federalism in this context. So that is the basis for Louisiana's claim. Louisiana kind of bought into the Common Core sale a number of years ago, and for all the right reasons. Louisiana, like a lot of states, is interested in elevating the standards in its public education system. That is, everybody can agree to that. Louisiana is certainly interested in its standards being compatible with other states and with our students being able to compete not just nationally but internationally. So all of the good virtues of Common Core, we have that interest in Louisiana. What happened, though, is that Governor Jindal rightly has referred to Common Core as a bait and switch. Common Core was created on the premise that this would be a voluntary set of standards that the states could use. And instead, the voluntariness now has proven to be illusory. Race to the Top program effectively co-opted the voluntariness component of Common Core and converted this into a nationalized agenda for capturing education curricula. And the word scheme is probably overused in the context of litigation. Everyone that's managed litigation to where they were challenging a number of moving parts probably has called their, probably referred to that process as a scheme, and I'm not sure that always works. In this case, though, it does work because the federal government is plainly attempting to accomplish very indirectly that which it is prohibited from accomplishing directly. That, by definition, is a scheme. So Louisiana, on Governor Jindal's leadership, started backing up last year, early last year, from Common Core, taking a hard look at wondering what have we signed up for. We being the what's referred to in this state as the Board of Elementary and Secondary Education, our BESSE board, which governs, it's a board of elected officials, which implements the policy of the legislature over education, public education. BESSE entered a PARC agreement, an agreement with PARC as a condition of the Race to the Top funding. This agreement does just what John's described. It essentially purports to hand over to the PARC governing board sovereign authority and sovereign decisions for the implementation of education policy within the state of Louisiana and all of the participating, each of the participating states. So Governor Jindal pulled back from this and requested that our legislature reverse course, and that last year was not accomplished. That led to the litigation. This year, I do think there's a substantial chance Louisiana will pull back from Common Core because there's now a great deal of focus on the influence of the federal government in this, and there's a great deal of focus locally at some of the challenges that have been faced in trying to abruptly insert this new education paradigm on into our history of how we teach education in this state. Our first theory in this case is the statutory theory. I think it is very simple, and I think the federal government knows they have a heck of a problem with it because recently, in filing their opposition to our litigation here in federal court, they attacked standing, and they attacked a number of other arguments that we've made, and they completely ignored the statutory claim, which is count one of our declaratory judgment action. I mean, it's remarkable how little attention was given to that claim by the federal government. It's as though if they ignore the language of these education acts, therefore they will not be held accountable for their infringement of the prohibitions. So our first claim is that the race to, and let me describe our claims. Louisiana is not challenging Common Core per se. It's very important because it's going to be difficult in a courtroom for anyone to challenge Common Core per se, because if the argument is that Common Core itself is bad and we're trying to get out of Common Core, what you're doing is you're requesting that the court render a decision on policy, on education policy, which takes you to another constitutional quagmire. Instead, the argument here is that the Race to the Top strings and the No Child Left Behind strings to Common Core, that those provisions are unlawful. So I've had to work very, very aggressively in trying to educate the court that this is not a challenge to Common Core per se. We will leave to the education policy experts as to whether or not this is good or bad policy. This is a challenge to actions by the federal government which intrude upon sovereignty provisions that belong exclusively to the state. So Our claim is that the race to the top conditions are unlawful, and the No Child Left Behind waiver authority is being exercised in an unlawful fashion. And it's unlawful for two reasons. Number one, because it offends provisions of congressional authority that have repeatedly restricted the department's authority in the realm of curricula, in the realm of instructional materials and local education issues. That's number one. And number two, that this not only offends the congressional prohibitions on the executive branch's authority to implement education policy, it likewise offends the 10th Amendment. It's a bit overlapping because these congressional prohibitions define the boundary for the federal government to exercise its authority into the realm of education policy without offending the 10th Amendment. So the arguments tend to lead one back to the other. But there are two different arguments here, the first being that, number one, it offends statutory language, and number two, it offends the 10th Amendment because it offends that. But the 10th Amendment is the reservation of rights to the states, which is ultimately offended. There's also a coercion component to the 10th Amendment argument because of the No Child Left Behind provisions. On the one hand, you've got the argument that the race to the top provisions weren't clear. They were relatively clear. And I think it put states in a position where it was very, very difficult for states. It was an offer they really couldn't refuse. The state of Louisiana is no exception to that. Each state is challenging, having very challenging fiscal times, and the opportunity to receive state funding for such a good intended or well-intended objective is raising education standards is very difficult for states to ignore. So the offer itself was very, very appealing, almost to the point of being one they couldn't refuse at the state level. But beyond that, there was never any intention or reference in Race to the Top that led states to believe that this would now be carried forward and tethered into the No Child Left Behind provisions going forward. And the statute for No Child Left Behind not only doesn't allow the waiver for No Child Left Behind provisions compliance to be tied to Race to the Top, there's a prohibition in No Child Left Behind which says no funding under this program states shall not be, as a condition of receiving funding under this program, required to adopt any particular curriculum. I would suggest that not only is there no authority in the No Child Left Behind Act that allows this type of waivers, I would go a step further and say, by its own terms, it prohibits this type of exercise of authority. So that, I believe, is a post-acceptance, if you will, under the spending clause authority of the federal government. It's a post-acceptance condition that I think states didn't sign up for. There's an article that the Heritage Foundation published, I think, last year, year before last, and I wish I could take credit for it because it's a great line. It concludes, and we used a great deal of it in researching the background for this lawsuit, but it concludes that Common Core is a lot like the line in the Eagles song Hotel California. States can check in anytime they like, but they can never leave. That is so perfect. It is absolutely perfect because that's what happened with Common Core. Louisiana is a perfect example of that. Louisiana got checked in, and now we have a governor who is doing everything he can to check the state out. It is very, very difficult to extract a state that once committed into this program because the federal government has not only tied you to Race to the Top, they've used other education provisions to tie you further into their objectives. So that's the nature of Louisiana's case. I look forward to answering any questions, and I will turn it back over to you, Dean.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I do want to open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see who rings in, let me make a quick programming announcement, and then I do want to revert to John Salver to see if he wants to augment his statement at all. But in terms of upcoming Teleforum conference calls, Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, We return to coverage of the U.S. Supreme Court with a special Courthouse Steps edition of Teleform when we'll be looking at Reed versus Town of Gilbert. That is a case that concerns the size of temporary road signs allowed for a small church to notice its weekly services and the time frame those signs are permitted to be displayed under a local town rule. That town rule provides for larger signs and longer display duration for other types of signs, like signs that include political speech. And that's Monday at 2 p.m. That's an argument that's taking place in the court Monday morning. Then Wednesday at 1 p.m., we'll be speaking with attorney Brian Tremont and FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai about net neutrality, as the commission seems now to be moving in the direction of regulating the Internet. With that, before we go back to John Sauer, 2, 4, 6, 7, we have 7 questions pending, John. So a lot of questions you guys have provoked already with your comments, but let me see if there's something you want to do by way of augmenting your opening statement.
No, I agreed with what was very well stated by Mr. Faircloth without exception, including his point that there is a provision in the No Child Left Behind Act that appears to directly contradict what the federal department purports to be doing with the No Child Left Behind waiver program. And in addition to that, I thank him for his reference to the Eagles, which was very well placed.
All right. Now let's turn to our audience for our first question.
Hi, Kevin Snyder, Sacramento, California. Here's my question. Other than a governor or a state superintendent of public instruction, do either of the panelists have an opinion as to whether a parent, a student, or a local school board have Article III standing to bring suit?
Well, this is Jimmy Faircloth. I'll respond standing if John doesn't mind, because I've had to oppose a motion to dismiss in Louisiana on a challenge to the governor's standing to assert that claim. I believe a parent would certainly have standing. In this case, we made the argument here. You've got parents whose children would be... The federalism debate is for the benefit of individuals. I mean, the federalism protections. And there was a decision in Bond, which was issued a couple years ago. Justice Kennedy wrote a wonderful opinion where he said that an individual has the authority to assert a Fifth Amendment violation because federalism at base is intended to protect the rights of liberty and the diffusion, to cause diffusion of power, rather than the rights of states per se to their sovereign, to protect their sovereign turf. So I think it's beyond serious debate that a parent would have authority to challenge, make at least a Tenth Amendment claim to Common Core. Now, other types of claims, I'm not sure, but the Tenth Amendment argument, I think, is clear.
And then this is John Sauer, and I think it's an excellent question. Just to follow up on Mr. Faircloth's statements, our lawsuit is actually a taxpayer standing lawsuit. So it is brought by not parents but taxpayers in the state of Missouri. It's in state court because Missouri, unlike the federal restrictions of Article III, Missouri has very liberal rules of taxpayer standing. And formally what we're challenging is the disbursement of payments in the form of membership fees by the state to the Interstate Consortium Smarter Balanced. Standing was an issue in our selection of that particular forum and approach. A parent's chief standing obstacle, to my mind, would have to do with redressability, because if the parent is in a forum where the state has voluntarily submitted to the Common Core standards and aren't trying to independently get out of them, then the question would be, if they sue the federal government for a declaration that all this is illegal, but there's a reason to believe that this state would implement Common Core anyway, that is, I think, at least a redressability issue that would be subject to litigation. I would be interested in hearing from a school district that there are a number of school districts in various states, in states that are still committed to Common Core, that might be interested in bringing litigation against the federal government for a declaration that the specific Common Core related conditions on the No Child Left Behind Act are unconstitutional, illegal under this provision of the No Child Left Behind Act that Mr. Faircloth referred to. I'd be very interested in hearing from a potential plaintiff like that. I think that any standing obstacles could be navigated therein, because parents are sort of one remove of redressability further away. I think a parent could have standing. I think there would be some litigation involved. It would create an issue.
If I can add, John, I think the key there is the nature of the claim. I think if the parent asserts the claim against the No Child Left Behind waiver authority or against the exercise of the conditions of Race to the Top, that is redressable. That is a Fifth Amendment claim I think a parent could bring. If a parent's claim is that my state has agreed to adopt Common Core and I think that offends federalism, I don't think that type of claim standing alone, you're going to have a redressability problem and you're going to have a difficult time proving standing. But we went through that here. We tried to be very, very specific in making the attack on the exercise of federal authority under Race to the Top and No Child Left Behind. And Louisiana is continuing to receive funding under the Race to the Top, and our waiver is still in place under No Child Left Behind. So we have standing because those are continuing to be ripe cases in which we can assert a claim. And I think a parent in those types of cases certainly could, but I do think the redressability issue becomes a little strained the more you move away from that narrow attack.
We've still got quite a few questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Hello, my name is Florence Thompson. I'm from Caputa, South Dakota. And my question is, what timeline do you anticipate this case will proceed? Or what do you expect?
Well, in our case, we are waiting for a ruling from the court on whether or not the governor has standing. We argued the case in November. I thought we would have an opinion during December. It did not occur. It could be any day now. And if the court finds standing, which I think we should prevail on that issue, the court has agreed to set a quick hearing on the motion for preliminary injunction that we sought. So in Louisiana, we could have a hearing within the next month, and then depending on that ruling, be at the Fifth Circuit within a couple months after that.
Thank you.
And then this is John Sauer. Our lawsuit is scheduled for arguments on summary judgment next Thursday, January 15th. We have received an order granting a temporary restraining order, finding a preliminary showing of success on the merits as to our compact clause claim. And then the full merits of the lawsuit will be submitted to the judge as of next Thursday. I don't know what the judge's timing to rule would be, but I'd hope within weeks or months, we would have a ruling on the merits that would then be ripe for appeal.
Let's keep rolling through these questions.
Hi, this is Derek Muller. I teach at Pepperdine University School of Law. Really interesting elements here to discuss, particularly, I think, some of the constitutional law issues. But I had two questions, primarily for John, but feel free to jump in, Jimmy. First, how is the scheme itself really set up? You mentioned a lot of things that it does. Is it really the case that the Department of Education is essentially sort of sending this money with the strings attached to it such that the consortium or these interstate organizations have a lot more control? They regulate the standards, they regulate some of the funding that goes in and the conditions for approval and things like that, because that strikes me as much more problematic under sort of a compact clause analysis claim. And then second, this is more of a sort of guesswork from, I guess, your end as litigators. The court has been very, very hands-off in spending clause cases, in compact clause cases. I'm wondering what you think are the features that are going to get the court's attention to take these matters more seriously than it might have in the past and turning more toward an original understanding of what Congress is authorized to do in this area, what the Department of Education is authorized to do in this area.
This is John Sauer and Professor Mueller. Thank you very much for your question. Professor Mueller has written some articles about the compact clause, and we've actually relied on his scholarship in our briefing in our case. I think you raised some excellent questions. We view, and essentially, I guess my answer to them, I can almost answer the both of them at once. I think the way that the consortium is set up does involve a binding commitment, purportedly binding commitment by a state official to cede authority over decisions about local educational policy within the borders of the state to the consortium, and that is a condition that was created by the federal government when it set up to the Race to the Top Top grant program. You know, the phase two of Race to the Top had solicited applications not from a single state, but from consortia of states, and these consortia of states had to involve these features. So there is a formal session of state authority, and that is one of several features that I think distinguishes the case of these interstate compacts from other interstate compacts that in the past few decades the court has approved. I think the Multi-State Tax Commission case from 1978 is a lead case on this, and in that case, I think the majority of the court bent over backwards to characterize the Multi-State Tax Commission as a purely advisory commission. You know, in the opening section of the opinion, it describes how when it promulgates regulations, they're merely advisory, it's merely suggested. They're trying to spin it almost as if it's like a, you know, Uniform Law Institute publication that the states can choose to adopt or not adopt. Now, there's pushback from that in the dissenting opinion from Justice White, who says, well, you haven't even described this thing correctly. Really, there is a session of authority. But in order to uphold the Multi-State Tax Commission, you know, or to hold that Congress's consent was not required to it, the Supreme Court emphasized the fact that it purported to be non-binding. This, I believe, given the nature and language of the memoranda that are involved in this thing, this is these are interstate compacts that do purport to be binding. They do purport to allow this, you know, to involve the states submitting to an outside governance structure to make key policy decisions on areas of traditional state concern. So if this issue were to ever reach, the court, I think that that is an important feature of these, you know, of these particular interstate compacts that will hopefully persuade the court not to go further down its I think wrong from an originalist perspective approach of being very hands off with respect to compact clause claims. And there's a second feature, and this goes to all the things that Mr. Faircloth was emphasizing, which is that these interstate consortia, the whole point of them is to allow the Federal Department of Education to attempt to evade all these federal statutes that say you can't do this, you can't impose. Well, if the compact clause, which says no state shall enter into an agreement or compact without the consent of Congress, doesn't mean that Congress has to consent to a compact whose sole purpose is to undermine or avoid congressional policy, then the compact clause doesn't mean anything at all. So the fact that there is this, that what these consortia are doing is, with the cooperation of the federal government, sort of in the teeth of restrictions that Congress has expressly placed on the executive branch, that also is a key feature that is not present, to my mind, in any of the lead Supreme Court cases on the compact clause.
John, if I could, this is Jimmy Faircloth, if I could add, and I want to, the reason this case is I think unique and will warrant review eventually by the court, is this is not a congressional exercise of spending authority case. The spending authority, I think, is pretty clear here, and the congressional limitations are very clear. What you have here is you have executive interpretation of that authority and their implementation of a program that I think offends the Tenth Amendment. And I think it's very important to keep in mind that what is really where the culprit here is the executive authority, not the congressional authority. And that is important. Keep this in mind. The American Recovery and Investment Act, the stimulus bill, which authorized the Race to the Top funding, it has general provisions that authorizes certain grants to be utilized to make improvements in education in certain areas. It does not in any way, shape, or form indicate that this creates some exceptions to the prohibitions in the other education acts. It's really what it is it's the executive branch is taking the general grant of authority for this particular funding platform and then avoiding the education policy debate, which has been so instrumental in those prohibitions that show up in those other education acts. And they've used that authority in a way that I think is trying to implement a scheme to accomplish something that Congress has said you couldn't do. And I think there's a clear example here. There's nothing in the ARRA, the stimulus, that authorizes any of these funds to be utilized to encourage a consortia to accomplish anything. That's very important. They borrowed, the executive branch borrowed that consortia idea from No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind specifically includes congressional authority to grant funding to consortia that agree to improve assessments. So what happened is, in adopting the race to the top, the executive branch said, hey, there's a good idea. Let's take the funding under the stimulus, which does not authorize funding to a consortia, and let's use the consortia to create the assessment component here. And that shows up in the Race to the Top assessment program. If you look at the Stimulus Act, it specifically says that it shall authorize a certain amount of funding to states through governors. So there's a real question here that has not been debated, and there hadn't been a great deal of commentary on it. And that is, by what authority does Race to the Top even utilize the concept of consortia? So I think that's a real good example that what you have here is an executive branch that is being extremely aggressive on a policy issue that Congress has drawn pretty clear lines on, and I think that is the reason why ultimately it will be heard.
And this is John Sauer. If I could just tailgate on Mr. Fairclough's point, that's an excellent point, that the federal department was borrowing the concept of consortium from pre-existing provisions of No Child Left Behind when it implemented all the Race to the Top grant invitations and related regulations. I believe that part of the motivation there was for the federal department to dress it up with a sort of apparent legality by pulling a concept out of pre-existing law that had already passed Congress, and maybe to answer Mr. Fairclough's previous reference to the Eagles with a quote from Shakespeare's Henry V, the federal department was seeking to dress it up with some shows of truth, though in pure truth it was corrupt and not.
Well, gentlemen, we've got fewer than 15 minutes left and now fully six questions pending. So I'm going to ask our callers to be as concise as possible, and let's try and get through as many of these questions as possible.
Thank you for your time. This is Rosie Schmidt in Andover, Kansas. Our state applied for Phase 1 Race to the Top but did not receive it. Therefore, is it advised to have Kansas still take the legal route described? And a little follow-up question. If we also get rid of our waiver, our No Child Left Behind waiver, are we then vulnerable again and sort of in no man's land? Thank you.
This is Jimmy Fairclough. I'll respond. Kansas applied for Race to the Top and did not receive it. I think that goes to the issue of redressability as well. I'm not sure of the basis for Kansas' rejection. If the rejection was in part based on your failure to meet the conditions of Common Core and the conditions related to the consortia participation, I think you certainly can bring a claim. If that rejection was for some other basis, I think it may create an argument that you do not have a redressable claim. So I think it's going to depend on the basis for Kansas' rejection or failure to meet the requirements to Race to the Top. With regard to the No Child Left Behind, I'm going to let John refer to that because I think that goes more to his commentary.
It does, and it is an excellent question. Oklahoma, you may be aware, was in a very similar situation. Oklahoma passed a statute this summer in 2014 where it pulled out of park and rejected the Common Core state standards. The federal department responded by revoking their No Child Left Behind waiver. I don't know the exact status of it. My understanding was that Oklahoma was trying to negotiate some kind of accommodation on that front because no state government wants to have No Child Left Behind reimposed on it because I gather every single state would be out of compliance, and there's a very substantial amount, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of funding at stake, and very intrusive remedies. I think that's why the correct approach would be to bring a declaratory judgment action stating that the conditions, the imposition of the Common Core related conditions, were without statutory or constitutional authorization. I believe the governor of Kansas, the appropriate political authorities in Kansas, for the reasons Mr. Fairclough said, would have standing to bring that claim if they want to get out of Common Core but retain the No Child Left Behind waiver. Of course, the threat to the waiver itself is a powerful deterrent to, I think, elected state officials from taking that particular action. To the extent there are Kansas school districts that have independent standing to sue or similar entities, then that might also be a legal option.
All right, moving on to the next question.
Good afternoon. I wondered if you could please briefly address some of the key substantive problems with Common Core in practice. Why is it so disliked?
This is Jimmy Faircloth. It's for many reasons. I mean, change is very difficult, and I don't want to pretend to be an education policy expert. I've attended a number of forums from local representatives of each school district, and that heard from parents and teachers that talk about some of the problems of implementing in Louisiana the platforms that are being used to align the Common Core standards. A lot of them are just simply because change is difficult and change is scary. But it appears to me that one of the real stumbling blocks is the fact that here in Louisiana, we are taking a generation of students who have learned in a certain methodology or paradigm, and we are, to a large extent, sacrificing those folks, those kids, for this new generation and this new education paradigm that we think will lead to better results. And that has caused a number of parents to really stand up and say, wait a minute, I have my son or my daughter coming to the house saying, here's my homework, I'd like to work on this, I don't understand how to do this, parents don't understand how to help them. And some of that is related here in Louisiana to the rush at the 11th hour to get Common Core integrated. When there was pushback here in Louisiana on Common Core, there was a real hurry up by the proponents of Common Core to implement it. And they pushed it down to the local levels very quickly, very abruptly. And the harshness of that probably resulted in some of miscommunications and probably made the delivery of it much more difficult than it should have been. But because of the top-down, cram-down effect, I think what happened is a lot of parents pushed back. A lot of children have had to change course mid-career in their educations. And I think there's just a lot of difficulty. I'm not going to go beyond that to talk about the actual substantive differences in Common Core-related platforms versus pre-Common Core platforms.
And this is John Sauer. I agree with what Mr. Faircloth said. I think there is concerns have been raised. I, like Mr. Faircloth, am not an expert in educational policy. I think there is a lot of concern about the actual substantive contents of the standards. For example, the mathematics standards want to teach math by teaching students strategies, identify four strategies for solving an addition problem rather than the more traditional and, to my mind, tried and true methods that involve much more rote and understanding gradually of evolving as students master the basic operations of mathematics. There's been pushback on the language arts standards, both from the right and the left, I believe, because they tend to, there's a tendency for them to replace sort of major classics, focus on classics like, Shakespeare and Milton and, Jane Austen to change the focus to more kind of technocratic writing. And so the idea is, are we, as a matter of substance, changing the focus of English and language arts education to much more technical writing rather than the classical understanding of what a liberal education should look like? That said, even if the Common Core standards were good policy, which I have grave doubts about, I think the concern about the manner in which they've been implemented as a top-down separation of powers violating, federalism violating mandate from a unelected federal bureaucracy is reason enough to oppose them.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
All right. We still have four questions pending. We'll try to get to as many of these as possible. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is David Tryon. I'm a lawyer and a former school board president in my local community. And two questions. So first of all, when I was early on, before it was actually implemented, there were some people that came out and said that Common Core is a bad thing. And so I went to our administration and said, they're saying it's a bad thing. What do you think? They saw those guys are just crazy. Don't ignore them. Well, as Common Core started to be implemented, more and more people said, hey, this is a bad thing. There's political indoctrination being incorporated into the curriculum. And there seems to be this even groundswell, which seems to be increasing against Common Core. My first question is, do you see that there is really a groundswell against Common Core across the nation, or am I just exposed to a few people that are against it? My second question is, I'd really like to hear the case citations, names and citations of your different cases so I could follow them.
Yeah, this is Jimmy. I do think there is a groundswell. We watched it here in Louisiana. I'll give you one quick example of why I think it is going to continue. I attended a meeting a couple weeks ago that involved teachers and parents who were addressing our local county, which is referred to as a parish school board, complaining about Eureka Math, which is the math version that they're using here to teach Common Core methodology, the aligned piece. Anyway, and they were outraged. This was an auditorium full of teachers and parents, and the school board members sat on the stage and literally shrugged their shoulders and could do nothing about it. And what was happening in that room was a perfect example of why federalism is important and why it is offended here. You had local concerns over a matter of that was very important at a local level, and you had local officials who were getting burned at the cross because of the difficulties, and they had no authority whatsoever. They couldn't answer the questions. They couldn't address the concerns. And it was really a great demonstration for the illusion that voluntariness exists, that states somehow have some say in this process. They really don't. So I do think there will be, I think that groundswell will continue. I do think the more parents that become frustrated with this process, the louder it will be, and I do think states will start to pivot in different directions. John, you want to answer there, the second question?
I agree strongly with what Mr. Fairclough said. We see a very powerful groundswell, really, in Missouri, dealing with a complicated infight between essentially grassroots activists, parents, and teachers who are very much in rebellion, so to speak, against this, whereas the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, the state educational department, is very much supporting it. So there is a major political battle going on between the grassroots and the establishment. I am rooting for the grassroots, and I believe they will be victorious in that battle here in our state, and I think there is similar rebellion or reaction, maybe a better word, in other states as well. As to the second question, which is, what are the captions of our case? Our case is captioned Sour Against Nixon. Nixon is the name of the governor of Missouri, and it's pending in state court in Cole County, Missouri, which is where Jefferson City, the capital, is. The case number is 14-AC-CC-00477.
Yeah, and our case is Jindal versus the U.S. Department of Education, Arnie Duncan. It's pending in the Middle District of Louisiana Federal Court. You can find it on PACER just by searching those terms.
This is Dean Royer. Let me ask our two presenters if you can go a minute or two long today, or do we need to have a hard stop at the top of the hour?
I'm available.
I can go as long as need be, Dean.
Okay.
Me too.
Let's take our next call. We've got three questions pending, so let's try and get through these if we could. Go ahead, caller.
Hello, this is Steve Cates from Bismarck, North Dakota, and a couple things. I think you've touched upon something that's really not discussed across the nation, which is critical, and this is the question of delegation of authority. And I don't think that the legislators understand that once Common Core entangles their state, they will have virtually no oversight in education. And so I can't tell you how important I believe this is, and I can't thank you so much for bringing this to the fore. Also, my question is to Mr. Sauer has to do with this idea of interstate compacts and the fact that they're saying that they don't take too much concern of interstate organizations if they don't impinge on the prerogatives or the power of the federal government. I see that as kind of a weakness in your case, and can you speak to that?
It's a terrific question. Under the original understanding or original meaning of the compact clause, there was no such restriction. The evidence from the founding era is that the compact clause agreements or compacts were intended to cover virtually all interstate compact, virtually any agreement among the states, because the states had a bad experience with them during the period of the Articles of Confederation, where agreements or compacts were permitted. They tended to promote regional factions and divisiveness, the founders believed. That said, it is true that the Supreme Court has retreated somewhat from the original understanding of the compact clause and has made statements such as the only compacts that tend to encroach upon the authority of the United States, the just supremacy of the United States, are those that that require congressional consent under the clause. That can be answered in at least two ways, several ways, I would say, but at least two ways. One is that in this case, there is a threat to federal authority. You have a federal regulatory agency trying to circumvent the authority of the U.S. Congress and flout a policy that's been expressed in 50 years of congressional statutes. If that doesn't require congressional assent under the clause, I don't know what does. Secondly, even though the Supreme Court's majority opinions have not emphasized this at much, they have at least consistently acknowledged that threats to the sovereignty of member states and non-member states are also red flags that indicate that Congress's consent is required to compacts. And for the reasons I've discussed, there are also threats to the member state sovereignty in these consortia and to the sovereignty of non-member states. So I believe under all three of those factors, the cases that have discussed, you know, threats to federal supremacy are fully consistent with a holding under current Supreme Court precedent that the Congress's consent is required to these particular interstate compacts.
Thank you.
Jimmy Haircloth, did you have anything on this point, or should we go to the next caller?
No, that's a great point. I have nothing to add.
Okay, let's take another question here.
My name is Al Agricola. I practice law in Montgomery, Alabama. I was calling just to commend to your reading a case in which I was counsel where the 11th Circuit held that we were successful in stating a claim under the 10th Amendment. I don't know if the government has challenged your cases for failure to state a claim under the 10th Amendment. But that case is Dillard versus Baldwin County Commissioners, D-I-L-L-A-R-D. It's 225 Fed 3rd, 1271. It's a 2000 11th Circuit case. And I hope it will be helpful to you.
Thank you very much. I look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
And now what seems to be our final question.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for taking the question. While these cases seem to address the government scheme for implementing the Common Core, another concern I have is the private scheme for mandating or implementing the Common Core. And it seems to me that that's occurring through organizations such as the College Board and or Scholastic, McGraw-Hill, Pearson. The College Board, through the testing regime of the SAT and the various AP exams, David Coleman, who now heads up the College Board, had been instrumental in developing the Common Core standards. And so wondering, while these questions and these discussions go towards these cases and the state's various efforts to move around what the government is doing through the race to the top, is there any way to address what's happening in the private realm with regard to, in essence, mandating these Common Core content, the Common Core content?
This is Jimmy. Are you referring to the private schools? Or are you referring to?
No, I'm referring to the private organizations, the College Board that offers the SAT exam and the various AP exams. And so, to the extent that these students across the country must take these tests, their content is determined by these organizations.
I think that's a great question. Here in Louisiana, one of the fronts that Governor Jindal has used to oppose this is our state procurement law, because when you sign up as a member of a consortium, in PARC for Louisiana in particular, you purport to sign over the authority to apply your state's procurement law, and you essentially delegate the fiscal integrity protections of state law to this board to make decisions regarding the contracting that will lead to the purchasing of and development and really the flow of money for the products, the assessments themselves. That's what I would refer to as inside baseball in the economics of Common Core. And a state like Louisiana, I'll give you a perfect example. If Louisiana is a member of a consortium and we participate in this national program that mandates these national assessments, the capacity of Louisiana's public school system is small in comparison to California or New York or these larger marketplaces. Well, I can assure you that the market forces that are behind the scene on the development of the assessments and the testing materials will start to drive the content. And as soon as that starts to happen, a system like Louisiana, for instance, will have very little say in that content. And you will start to see cultural and regional biases that show up where the heavier capacity is located. And that is part of what offends state sovereignty here. And that the economics at the end of the day will drive a great deal of this. And with that in mind, people need to be very, very aware where the capacity is located. And that capacity will drive, I think, the development of these testing materials and the assessments and the instructional materials.
And that is the root of my concern, because with the AP, the rewriting of the AP United States History exam, where you're able to access a sample of it, which is merely the sample that the board itself, the College Board, put forward, so it's hand-selected, that in itself shows a very strong redirect on content that does appear to have the same type of political bias that you hear many people complaining about. And I know that that's not something you want to get into on this call, but to the extent that this, as you said, these consortiums and their procurement, both through textbooks and through their testing paradigms, the question I have is, well, what can be done once that begins to occur?
We're fighting here in Louisiana by having our Division of Administration, under the governor's direction, challenge these procurement decisions that our Department of Education, under the direction of the Board of Elementary BESSE Board, which governs education. So there's an internal struggle in Louisiana that's led by the governor saying, dig in on these procurement issues and let's make sure that these procurement decisions apply Louisiana law so that we do not lose control of the economics, if you will, of developing these assessments and materials. Because if we lose control of the economics of that and we can't control it, the fiscal integrity of it, we're going to lose control of our ability to influence the material itself.
Thank you.
And this is John Sauer briefly addressing the same question and agreeing again with what Mr. Faircloth said. It seems to me that the big picture is parents and teachers, by and large, now that they're finding out about Common Core this school year, really don't like it, and they're going to continue to not like what they see. But the federal government is artificially propping it up with the threat to the No Child Left Behind waivers and putting intense pressure on the states to remain into it. If lawsuits like these were to succeed, go on to succeed and peel off that pressure, then I think you'll see a rising tide of states opting out. And if the states are saying, because we're reacting to our voters and they do not want these assessments in our schools, they don't want this curriculum in our schools, that makes it very, very much more difficult for, these private testing organizations that devise the SAT and the ACT and so forth to say, well, we're going to be aligned to Common Core. Well, if, 35 states are not teaching Common Core, then that's really a threat to, it becomes very difficult for those private organizations to hold that pressure. Right now, what makes that threat strong is that it's done in cooperation with the threat of the federal government to the states.
So it seems to me the takeaway then is, in addition to these lawsuits, there is a true need for a grassroots ground game to get parents and teachers to literally use their voices to influence states to move away.
Absolutely. The grassroots movement is much more powerful than the lawsuits.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, this is Dean Reuter again. My thanks to Jimmy Faircloth and John Sauer. This has been a terrific call. I certainly appreciate as well you staying with us so we could get through all our questions. I want to thank the audience as well, calling in great numbers, and appreciate your thoughtful questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled telephone conference call Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be talking about the Supreme Court argument that morning, Reed versus Town of Gilbert. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.